This is the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello and welcome. We are in the next phase of the Agile Uprising Agile Manifesto author review. Today we're lucky to be joined by James Grenning. I am your host, Ryan Lockard, along with James Gifford. So we have dueling Jameses today, and we're going to try to keep that as unconfusing as possible. Mr. Grenning, thank you for joining us today.
Mr. Grenning, okay, that's what my kids' parents would call me, but not anymore. They want to be on the same basis now that they're older. But thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm going to do as much as I can to demystify who I'm talking to here and see how quickly that falls apart. We've been working our way through the different authors of the manifesto, and we are well over the hump now. And we've been following a format where we start off and we ask, what were you working on prior to 2001 when you got invited out to Snowbird and be part of that monumental event? Your history is pretty well recorded, but for anyone that's either new or some of the younger folks in the Agile industry that may not be as familiar with you, do you mind just giving a overview of your professional history in the years leading up to 2001?
Sure. I've got a really long story, but I won't tell that one. But the short version is I tried to avoid computers in high school. In engineering school, I ran into a little bit of programming that I couldn't avoid and found out how much fun it was, then realized someone would pay me. And when I got my first job, they handed me this book about some device. So I became an embedded systems engineer. In 1982, I went for my second job interview. I happened to meet Robert Martin. He hired me at the company we worked at. We worked kind of near each other for about 10 years. In the mid-90s, after I kind of worked my way up a management chain and discovered the corporate world, I'd learned what I wanted to there. I started consulting with Bob. And then in 1999, I saw Kent Beck showing test first development, and that was kind of an epiphany moment for me. We can maybe talk about later. Mm-hmm. I was learning extreme programming from Kent and Ron and Martin Fowler and company in this 1999-2001 timeframe, and so that's what I was doing before then. So I was really kind of learning a lot of this stuff. I'd come from a pretty heavy design background with embedded systems, some management, and a design background from having worked with Uncle Bob or consulting for maybe 7 or 8 years before coming to the Agile Manifesto meeting.
Yeah, I think it was Uncle Bob that when we interviewed him, he had mentioned a specific project he was working on, and I'm blanking on the industry right now, but he mentioned being locked in a room no bigger than a broom closet with a couple other men working on this project. And I'm curious, was this you? Were you one of the guys locked in the broom closet with Uncle Bob?
I wasn't in that closet, I don't think. I've never been locked in a closet for work, although we were in the telecom business, so it was probably a closet that had some telecom gear in it that, no, I didn't end up in that closet with Bob.
All right. I was curious if you're the man that lives to tell the tale. Nice. So I guess it's a pretty awesome experience to say that you cut your XP teeth with Ron, with Martin, and with Kent. How did you first get engaged with them? What was the connecting point to?
In the late 90s, and this might feed over into some of the other things you're interested in. In the late 90s, kind of 90s, whatever, I know in the 80s, we were trying to kind of figure out how to do software development, and this idea of improving your process was big. And waterfall was kind of the thing that I was trying to help my company do because we were just so chaotic. We had to do something to start getting better. In the 90s, perspective was if you had a better process, the people wouldn't matter. Mm. And so there's a Watts Humphreys book. I'm not sure if that's what he really meant, but that's what people got from it. When they read it, that's what they got from it. Just like people reading the Agile Manifesto will say, oh, you're not supposed to do any documentation. How stupid is that? I'm not sure what we, if we got the right message from Humphrey's book or not, but that was kind of the way the 90s were. Let's see. When I start rambling like this, I might sometimes lose track of the question. But so you're asking me kind of how I got started with them. And then in the late 90s, what Object Mentor, Bob's company, was doing at that time is trying to find out, you know, what can we do besides just coach people in design? Could we coach people in process and how to do stuff? And so we were trying to think about that, and extreme programming happened then. And we got interested in it. And Bob and his business partners at the time, seeked out Kent and Ward and Ron and Martin and said, hey, let's do this thing where we can train people, because our business was training. And I was working on a job with Motorola at the time as a consultant, teaching them better modeling and better use case design. And Lowell Lindstrom, one of Bob's partners there, said, James, come to Extreme Programming Immersion 1 next week. Oh, well, then I won't get paid, right? It's like, nope, you won't get paid. It's like, okay, I'll be there. That was when I got exposed to all this stuff. And it was kind of, you know, we were already kind of incremental, working in small cycles the way we worked. And now here's some form around that. And to me, considering I was ready, not everybody's ready to hear these ideas and accept them. But I was ready to, they didn't all look like great ideas, but they all look like, oh, okay, I understand why these smart guys are recommending this. Maybe I'm going to learn more about that. And that's kind of how I got, kind of the flavor of the 90s before then, and kind of where the industry was, and then how I got started in it. One thing that was really important to me with my particular background as an embedded systems developer, 20 years of experience, is when I saw Kent writing some Java, which I didn't really, I knew a little bit in Java at that time. Saw Kent test driving Java code using JUnit. It was kind of there's no video on this, but I'll, for you guys' benefit, they're looking at me on the screen. I was like, for 20 years, we were developing embedded systems where we didn't have anywhere to run the code, and maybe we could have run the code in a unit test harness, was this light bulb. And that kind of got me to where what I'm doing today, because it's like, I think this is going to be important for this world of embedded systems. And so the next day, when I went back to Motorola, I started talking about this and getting them to experiment. So I got to experiment the day after Extreme Programming Immersion on this group at Motorola. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so I imagine that was kind of the catalyst then for what became your heavy research and your heavy pioneering work done for the test-driven development within Embedded C.
Yeah, and I wouldn't really call that research. I would call that practice.
Yeah.
Right? We just started doing it and finding out what worked and, you know, some things that didn't work. And, so be nice to call it research. I'm no researcher. I've got a son that's a researcher.
Yeah. It's funny, whenever we talk about the scientific method, I was having a conversation at some lean conference, and there was actually a scientist in the room.
Yeah.
And that's when you quickly find out what we've been calling scientific method is about as bastardized as what I just referred to as research.
Yeah, okay. You make a hypothesis and okay. Yeah. No worries though.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? You said you were asked to go to the XP version 1 conference for a week, and you asked if you got paid. The answer was no. Late last night, James Gifford, the guy on the phone here, and myself and another guy were talking about things we kind of wish we could go back, if we had a time machine, if you will, go back and figure out what we would tell ourselves a few years ago or 10 years ago going into this stuff. And it's we want the advice that really kind of resounded was what you just said. Take those learning opportunities, even if you have to pay for it yourself, even if you have to go unpaid to go out there and to acquire that knowledge. I find it ironic and almost like a stroke of karma that less than 12 hours ago we were having this conversation, and here we are sitting with you, and you're saying the same thing. So,
yeah. Well, hard to know what those moments are, really. You can't know. So you said that, and you're making me think of something that happened to us, to me in the 90s, in the 80s, working for a big company called Teradyne. It's where Bob and I worked together. And we were supposed to use TQM, which TQM influenced a lot of things. If I look at what was taught in the 80s in TQM, there's a lot of that in Agile, structured problem solving and such, small cycles and this sort of thing. And then when they came to us and said, we want you guys to work in small cycles too. And we said, oh, we're software developers. Our cycle is a year. We've got to do requirements and then design, and we can't do a short cycle. What would that cycle be? And so we got basically a waiver for not having to do TQM. I wish it's at that point, a little thing would have appeared on my shoulder and said, yes, you can work in short cycles. This is kind of the amazing thing that Kent and Ward did in my mind, which is they didn't say the status quo is the way we work. That is the only way. They said, oh, there's problems with this. People change their mind. We have to keep retesting. And then they invented these practices of extreme programming. It's just kind of, to this day, the insight for them to do that is still, I don't know what the right word is. It's just, you know, kind of amazing that they had that insight and were able to do that. And
It's the insight and it's the awareness of the situation, because we all have those insights, right? But we rarely act upon them and find ourselves into such a giant shift in the way the industry thinks about delivering value. So
yeah, right.
So I think I should ask the question for consistency's sake, but I'm 99% sure I know what you're about to say here. Around late 2000, early 2001, when everything was kind of shaping up for the meeting in Snowbird, do you recall how you were contacted, who reached out to you, and what degree of activity you had on the forums or the wiki or the phone calls that led up to this?
Well, my part was very small in that. So it goes kind of like this. Bob, who I worked with, was planning was trying to get this plan. He was talking to another Dave Thomas, not the one that was at the Agile Manifesto, but the Dave Thomas that he's got a home in the Caribbean islands. And Bob was saying, we got to get this meeting together of these people that, you know, are doing all this similar stuff. It's like, it's going to be in the Caribbean or at Snowbird. James, you want to go? And okay. So I love to ski. So, yeah, I think we should go to Snowbird, or, you know, the Caribbean would be fine too. So I wasn't really part of the, it was the organizers there were Bob and Alistair for the most part, the way I understand it. You probably hear more from them about that, but they were kind of the organizers. And then, I think that it became easier for people to get to Salt Lake, which I was good with, because I've skied all my life and really like to. So having a chance to go to Snowbird is kind of big.
Yeah. And so far your memory that has been shared by the others is pretty spot on. It was mostly, I'm sure other people had influence over the organization, but the definite forces were Bob and Alistair, given what everyone else has been saying. Except for when you talk to Bob or Alistair, they then say it was everybody else. So it's kind of beautiful the way they...
you know, you got a bunch of guys that are accomplished in, you know, with some big egos, I think, and nice of them to, they're also generous, very generous people.
Yeah. So speaking of those generous people, you take the trip out to Utah. I'm assuming you're on a flight. Did you travel with any of the guys that you knew prior, or did you go out solo?
I probably went out solo. My wife went with me on that trip. So we went together.
Okay.
I wouldn't have traveled with Bob, I don't think.
Okay. And then the story that's been told to me is that there was the formal structure for the meeting. But the night before the first morning, you guys kind of got together either at the lounge or somewhere in the lobby, or you managed to congregate somewhere and just go through the pleasantries of shaking hands or the folks that you'd not met before and catch up with some of the other guys you knew. First of all, does that sound familiar? Do you remember that?
Given that my wife was with me, I think we might have done something else that night. Mm-hmm. I also might have been out there in a job, because I was doing a lot of work at that time, and Ron and I were both consulting at a company out there, Symantec, in American Fork, Utah. So I might have been out there for that also. I'm not I'm not sure, you know, United might know.
Yeah. But. Nice. So the, when you did finally catch up with them, either, the next morning, or whenever, was there anyone in that group? I mean, you mentioned quite a few people that you knew leading up to it. Was there anybody in that group that you had no prior knowledge of, that it was a 1-0 experience for you? It was the first time you met them?
No, let's see. Yeah, there's a number of people that I didn't know before. Let's see. So the guys I did know were Kent and Ward and Ron and Bob, of course,
mm-hmm.
And Martin. So I'd met those guys before. Mike Beadle, he's from Chicago, so I knew him. Ken Schwaber and Jeff Sutherland, I didn't really know of because I wasn't really following the scrum thing. Alistair, I'd met before. I'd gone skiing with Alistair a few times. I just kind of, as I was out there and I knew he lived there, I just pinged him one day. And because of my connection with Bob, he was willing to meet with me. And we had a great time skiing prior to that. So I knew Alistair coming in. And then John Kern, I didn't know. He's become a good friend, though, since then. Steve and we've stayed in touch as well. So I don't know, that's kind of my connections were pretty loose with most of the guys, Bob close and then Kent.
I guess the first day there was a loosely structured, I'm going to call it an agenda, but it was mostly, I think it was a list of items that Alistair put together to kind of guide the conversation. John Kern actually made his personal copy available to us that we put up on our website through the agileuprising.com for community. And what I understand is you put 17 alpha males in a room to have a conversation, and quickly that agenda probably fell by the wayside. And what quickly emerged was a living agenda using index cards. Does that seem familiar to you?
Yeah. And I kind of forgot this. So one of the guys I was consulting with in American Fork several years later was talking to me, and he was saying, after that meeting, you told me that you threw out the note cards. One of the things that an extreme programming coach would do, and it would still do to this day, is have with them at all times a stack of note cards just in case someone needed to start brainstorming something. And this is where, in reflecting on some of this stuff, one of the things that in TQM that we learned was, if you want to do brainstorming, have people write down their ideas. Mm-hmm. And don't just start saying them and have someone transcribe onto a board, because the arrows and shotguns are going to come out and start blasting things out of the sky, and then everybody's going to shut up. And so by collecting your ideas without tainting them by, having them be rejected immediately by someone that has a different idea or whatever, we're able to do that. And so that would have been a very natural thing for me to do. I don't have a personal memory of doing that, but my friend Jean Johansson, who lives out there, and we were coaching with him, he said, "No, you told me that story afterwards." He's an early adopter of extreme programming, and so I take his word for it that I had something to do with us moving to note cards, even though if I didn't do it at that moment, someone else probably would have within moments.
Well, I can tell you this. I know when I spoke with Alistair, he was funny. He said that the agenda did go out the window, and quickly the damn XP guys pulled out index cards, and quickly everyone was trying to beg, borrow, and steal index cards from you guys.
Well, there you go. So there's a little collaboration there.
Yeah. And what's interesting too is that we talked about this aspect of the story with Ron Jeffries a week or so ago, and even today he's sitting there on the video with us, and he, as I was talking about the note cards, he literally in front of him had his own note cards, and he was holding them up, showing me to this day he's still using them.
I had a stack of them sitting here, but they got put away. I put them away somewhere.
Yeah.
Because I met a friend last night for a beer at the local place on the Intercoastal here, and I brought them with just in case we would need them.
That's beautiful. I would like to say that I bring note cards or index cards with me to the bar too, but I'd be lying to you.
Okay. I haven't seen this guy for a while, and we're business friends, so we thought there might be something like that. But Well, you better start, you know. You never know.
Yeah. So, assuming.
If
you need them, though. So.
Yeah.
I always have a pack of post-it notes and a Sharpie in my pocket. Pretty much every day.
Actually, James Gifford has the Scarmando belt. If you ever want to see what that is, I'll send you a picture. It's a way for him to walk around and have easy access to index cards, highlighters, stickers, and Sharpies at all times.
All right. Is there a hammer hoop for it too, or?
We replaced the hammer hoop for a Nerf gun at one point in time. But it is quite the utility belt.
Yeah. Okay. I asked about the hammer because I like doing stuff to my house, and so I'll wear one of those on Saturdays, you know, a lot. So
nice. So assuming the index card story is sort of in your memory, or I'll even allow you to do a little editorializing here. What do you think would have been one of the items that you wrote down on the card, on several of your cards and put it up for conversation?
Well, you know, I don't know what that would have been, but I'll tell you what was surprising to me. Because I kind of came there as an engineer. And as an engineer, I'm interested in solving problems. And as an engineer, extreme programming was very appealing to me because it seemed like a very good way to solve engineering software problems, software programming problems. It seemed like a superior way of doing it. Now, when I would get to talking to Alistair, he would say, you know, the process isn't as important as the people and how well they can communicate. And it's like, no, the process, no, extreme programming is this thing that's wonder, you know. Yeah, and he goes, yeah, extreme programming, I think all those things that they're hard to do. And the first order effect is getting people to having good people that can communicate well. And, you know, some experts, but not everybody experts, like, okay, you know, so it was surprising to me at this time that there was such a focus on the people aspect. I was kind of the mindset of if we could show someone a better process, they will naturally want to do it like we just convinced ourselves to do over the last 2 years. You know, that it's the best way to work. You know, so that was kind of my perspective. I don't know what I would have written down, but it would have been more technical than the things that ended up in the top couple of points there. Mm. Now, okay, so there's more to talk about there, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I think the first observation I have is that I think I'm not sure if when Bob and Alistair were putting the list together, if it was done by design, or if we as in the agile/technical/software community just got dumb lucky that you had those two different points, because it forces the conversation. Without you talking about the process and the technical excellence aspects, it would have been too much focused on the people. And without Alistair there, we would have just had an implementation guide for better technical practice and process, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I gotta really hand it to Kent's I think it's Kent and Ward that I heard Kent say this, but I think he probably developed it with Ward, which is, you know, why are you doing this? And what he was telling, you know, at the time he would offer, I'm trying to make the world safe for programmers and for people that need programs. And so there was a definite view there by those really insightful guys that we needed to mend the relationship and make it a collaborative relationship and not a adversarial relationship, which unfortunately to this day still exists very strongly in most of our industry. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself there. So
let me ask this, is there anything, you know, because there was the conversation between the balance of technical versus the humanity aspect of it. Is there anything that you were championing that you feel was not included or significantly shifted from the way you proposed it to what was included in the manifesto?
Not really. What I have to say about, you know, kind of my role there was, you know, partaking in discussions, but really I was learning from these guys a lot. And, you know, I kind of got there as a, a very senior, experienced developer in design and time spent in management and that sort of thing. But I wasn't creating this stuff. I was learning from these guys. That's really kind of where my mind was at that time. I'll let you keep asking questions rather than go off on a tangent now.
Tangents are fine. We do that quite often.
people that were there, which, it's interesting from the business perspective, having the business people there and, me having, 10 years of experience in management as well as development, I can relate to a lot of the issues there and, having wanted the waterfall and known that it's, it's like hard to get it. And then also implementing that, it's like all this stuff rang very true to me, given that I had experienced a lot of the problems. Many people aren't ready to take some of this stuff because they haven't experienced and don't actually recognize the problems as problems, like debug later programming. You mean there's something we can do besides write the code and then go find the bugs? Could we prevent them? Well, if you think it's not possible, you don't even think of how you might do it. So we get kind of set in our ways, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think that extends well beyond, debugging software and even technology in general. Like if I were to sit there and start throwing solutions at somebody for a problem that they don't even know they have, first of all, they're not going to listen to me. And then if I do brute force the solution on them, they're going to bastardize it in such a way that they never see the value that was intended in the first place. So I think...
Hence most agile adoptions that happen.
Yeah, now we are getting to that point. So I'll tell you one last question about Snowbird and then we'll shift over to that current day scenario. Is there anything that you feel should have been included in that original artifact or something that should have been changed looking back at it now?
Well, I don't really, I kind of think of it as a history, a moment in time. None of us there actually thought anybody would care. We did it because we wanted to find out what the other areas, other people had in common with us. And then we felt we kind of needed to band together a little bit because there was a big, push into processes getting heavier. And we were kind of, you heard all about the name, right? The lightweight process.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't need to repeat anything about that. But, thinking back to that, I kind of just take it as it was what it was. It sounds kind of fatal, fatalistic or, that we couldn't have done better. And I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, at the time, that those were important things to talk about. One thing I did want to mention about the meeting was, have you talked to Steve Meller yet?
We have not. We're actually working on scheduling with him actively.
Okay, because Steve, the word code, I'm convinced that the word code would have been in the Agile Manifesto if Steve Meller had not been there. Because Steve was really into model-driven. So, early guy, and we're going to make a model, and then we'll convert the model into code. And so he was really focused on making sure that the word software was there, where if us XP guys would have, not been throttled a little bit by him. Code would have been in the Agile Manifesto, alienating it maybe a little bit more from the world than it should have been. So I think that abstraction that Steve brought and insisted upon was, it's executing, right? It doesn't matter if it was, code or a model or whatever. So.
That's interesting. That's actually, I think we're at like number 11 so far, but I think that's the first time I've heard that, which is, I appreciate you sharing.
Sure. Thank you.
So you shift out of 2001, you guys released the Manifesto for Agile Software Development, I believe is what the formal title is. Ward makes the website available to the masses, and almost immediately it takes off like a brush fire. Is that how you remember it?
Yeah, I guess I was kind of surprised by all that. I didn't know that there was anything to do there. Yeah, and I can't say that I really followed it a lot either. It wasn't until a couple of years later that I realized that, you know, that it was such a big deal.
Do you remember one of those early, you know, signals or the, that, hey, this is actually something. It's not just a, it wasn't a good excuse to go skiing for a couple of days. And this is taking history.
Well, first off, it's always good to have an excuse to go skiing for a couple of days. I'm working on another one right now.
Nice.
I'm sorry, I'm distracted by the word skiing.
Yeah, no worries. What was an early key that the Agile Manifesto was getting some roots in the industry?
Well, I guess in the early 2000s, Object Mentor started a conference called XP Universe. Hmm. And then a couple of years later, another conference pops up, which is Agile. And it's like somebody else talking about the same thing. And it's like, now there's all of a sudden, and it was, you know, started by Alistair and it was going to be in Salt Lake. And I guess that was the first event that made me think, that's, you know, started something else, something, you know, there's people that are going to find out more about this.
This thing we created is creating its own things now.
Yeah. It was having a conference. Right. You know, so Extreme Programming already had a conference. I don't know if Scrum did, but then this Agile conference, right, out in Salt Lake, again, back in the place where the writing of the manifesto happened, if you abstract Snowbird into Salt Lake, go up one level.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so I think that's the first thing I really recall of that. And then I could go back in my history and find out the first papers that I wrote about using Agile for, because the wording changed. So extreme programming was always something kind of that scared people. And Agile was something that, you know, who would argue with that? But extreme, it's like, oh, we got to put on our helmets and elbow pads. But Agile, it's like, well, of course, yeah, we want to be Agile. Do we want to be extreme? No, we're running a business here. We don't want to be extreme. So there was a problem with that. And I know the first paper I wrote about applying the ideas to embedded systems was extreme programming for embedded systems. I submitted to the embedded systems conference. And then I think after a couple of years, I changed it to the softer wording Agile. You know, now I think some might today say, yeah, we need to go back to extreme programming now that Agile's been watered down. Hmm.
It's interesting that's an interesting perspective, because, you know, I think extreme programming, or XP, is what basically everyone's using now. It's just been so ingrained into the syntax of what we do that it's funny to hear that there was a time where it was almost shunned because of the nomenclature associated. So
now you're in a small group of people that view it that way, I would say.
Even today?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, at the current company I'm at, you really can't talk about extreme programming. If I'm talking about extreme programming and its practices, I have to just refer to it by the practices. As soon as you start bringing in extreme, it takes a bad connotation, even today. So,
God, maybe I'm stalling my career by talking about XP. Jeez.
I mean, no. So we talk about it as good development practices. We talk, you know, we bring up things like clean coding. We don't, even when we start dropping names of people that have done it, it's a gigantic turnoff to the entire audience that we work. So I can't bring up Uncle Bob Martin's name and talk about clean coding and it jive. Like, people, as soon as they hear a name or extreme programming or any of those things, it shuts them down. But if you're just talking about the practices and talking about test-driven development and good unit testing and things like that, it's more widely adopted. So there is definitely a connotation there.
Man, this is actually interesting. So just to hopefully set context here. I'm not talking to executives or to project managers or to people in the business about XP practices. You still think even in the technical world, like within software developers and technical peers, that XP is a little bit of an outlier?
I would say yes.
Holy cow. Okay. I learned something today.
Well, you learned two guys' opinions.
Yeah, well, it's something I will continue to research at least.
Yeah.
Or well, not research. I used that wrong already, so it's something I'll look into.
Well, I work a lot with my universe is maybe a little bit different, although I travel in several universes. If I think about embedded systems as one, people doing embedded systems, oftentimes they're still working in C, programming of, in a primitive environment and using fairly primitive ways of designing. How do they separate things and all this kind of stuff that, maybe you take for granted. Mm-hmm. But, there's a lot of the world out there that really, they do their job. They get their programming done, they go home. They don't live it as much as some of us do, right? It's not as much a part of the things that you want to do in your discretionary time also, right? I'm presuming that you guys on the phone here are involved in it more than just at your job.
Yeah, much to our family chagrin.
Yeah, obviously by this phone call.
Yes.
Yeah. So. I mean, the embedded system area is extremely interesting. And I spent a lot of time monkeying around with Arduino boards and building shields and things like that. But all of that, all those sketches and things like that, it kind of changed how a lot of this work was done. I've never actually had the opportunity to get in and actually write C for, these microprocessors and microcontrollers and things.
A lot of the guys that I teach, they tell me about, the embedded systems engineers, that it's, their world is special. Yeah, of course it's special. One of my messages, it doesn't really matter. These things help. But now I'm kind of getting to feel some of the pain that they feel because I'm working on this Internet of Things project with my brother. Now, I'm not programming this in embedded C, but it's this kind of micro Python that I'm working with. And in this environment, I'm discovering, well, I don't really understand the universe of this Internet of Things development environment enough to actually test drive this code. What I have to do is discover how these things work. And that means plugging things together, running little snippets of code, seeing if the radios can talk to each other and all this kind of stuff. And eventually, once it's like I come across a magic formula to get things to talk, usually with help from their technical support, now it's like, okay, I know what works. Now I need to make this sustainable code. So it's like, okay, I've got this mess that I made that works. Now let's make sure I understand it. Let's start writing tests and extracting the code that works with the radio and start to put in a layer of abstraction so that I can fake out, reading the A to D converter. So I don't have to really have an A to D converter there. I can have a fake one of those so I can read that in and then get that to be transmitted or, pseudo transmitted, not really transmitted because I want to write a test. So I can write the, exercise on my Mac computer, for instance, rather than in this little tiny radio environment. Mm. So kind of the fun there has been, this getting the real things to work, which in my job going and consulting with people, you don't always get to do. But in this environment, I can do that. And then what do I do once I discover what works? Am I done because I got it to work? And this is something that kind of bothers me about a lot of engineering is that if I get it to work, lots of people stop working on the code once it works. For me, I know I just created the first prototype of a product that I'm going to be working with potentially for years. Mm-hmm. And I want that code to be understandable by me and by someone else. And so I then after getting it to work, I'll extract the code and start test driving the modular pieces I need. I noticed our connection was going bad again, but are we okay?
You're good. There was
I think we're okay.
Just this week, there was an article I was reading that Kent was interviewed, and he was talking. The article hinged around reversibility of decisions and code, and I think the tagline or the clickbait was Kent Beck loosens his approach to TDD just slightly, and it's sort of akin with what you just said. Did you happen to see that article? It's probably about a week or two old.
No, I didn't see it. I should probably take a look at it though.
I'll dig it up and I'll get you a link. But what's interesting is the only scenario where Kent seemed to relent on the importance of TDD is when you're doing that exploratory or that pure prototyping, where you know that it's almost going to be either throwaway work or where you're just trying to learn the domain. And it sounds like it sounds almost exactly like what you just said.
Yes. So over the last couple of years, I've done some stuff I haven't done before. One is to build my website, wingman-sw.com. Oh, shameless plug. Wingman software.
It was
wingman-sw.com. So it's a Rails application. And so I've learned a lot of, I'm a novice at Rails, but I've done enough to be able to build my website to do what I need to support my business.
Well, I think James mentioned earlier he's got a pretty good friendship going with John Kern, and John will talk your ear off about Rails for all day long.
No, I got to contact him more often than I forgot that. He's not on my short list of guys to call with Rails questions.
I should definitely. I mean, I'm going to formally apologize to John Kern now, but go ahead and spam him.
Yeah. So, well, you were telling me about the Kent Beck article.
Yeah.
And I thought I would just mention another thing about, you know, so people sometimes will hear someone talk about test-driven development and think, oh, they're being religious about it. And for me, it's really about being an engineer. And using that problem-solving technique when it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding in working in Rails, this, you know, I've just started 2 years ago working on my website. I've had some help from friends that know something about it. And then they abandoned me and I had to learn it all my, you know, I had to learn enough to keep evolving my website. And I've discovered that certain areas are amenable to testing and certain ones aren't. If you just go drop all your code into the model, you're going to be disappointed and make a big mess like I did. And once I got familiar enough with Rails and got my system to work and started discovering the kind of problems I run into, which is, you know, when you go and change this model and you don't have tests, you're going to have unintended consequences, which is exactly what happened to me. It's like you better figure out how to repartition the model part into something that you can test and leave all the Rails stuff at arm's length. I've discovered no reason for me to bother testing views. I get those to make me happy enough, and I leave them alone. Mm-hmm. No real need for me to test controllers at this point because I keep them really simple, straight-line code. Where the interesting stuff is business logic of my things that would be tossed into the model and trying to then structure code in that area such that I can be confident when I make a change to something in the model that I don't break something else and that I have the intended consequences. And it's been kind of fun because I run into the stuff that people say are is a big concern. It's like, well, what if I'm going to have to maintain these tests? It's like, yeah, okay, you will. What if I make a change and I don't need some tests anymore? It's like, well, you're going to have to look at the tests and decide. It's like, okay, so one day I'm making the changes and a bunch of tests fail. It's like, well, I don't even want this behavior anymore. So I don't just delete the tests. I go in and make sure I get rid of the code that was involved with that and delete the tests and, you know, try to keep to within the low technical debt environment, you know, where everything that's needed and tested. But that's kind of
that's excellent. It's a very real conversation that happens in dev shops all across the world. So
yeah,
super relevant. So taking a step out of the deep software engineering and the computer science and into something that I think is a commonly accepted practice today that not many people know the origins of. I'm going to assume most of the listeners that we have been in some form of Agile or Scrum planning session. And, the majority of the teams I've worked with, and I think it's a small sample, but I would extrapolate that out. A lot of teams use points, story points, the Fibonacci sequence or some modification thereof. And if you've been practicing in Scrum or Agile for any period of time, you've probably used planning poker, and I think it's worthwhile mentioning that you may have had a hand in this. Is that accurate?
In the early 2000s, I was working with Object Mentor. One of the roles I played was business coach, is what we called it. We would kind of help people get their stories together and do some estimation and such. So I was playing that role mostly, some technical coaching, but also this business coaching role. And in one of the meetings that I was facilitating, we had eight people there. Two of the architects were in the room, and you know, six other people that weren't the architects. And as a story would get brought out, it would get debated for an hour. And these weren't very small stories, because we really hadn't figured out how to make stories small yet. And I, you know, here I'm coaching this team, and I didn't really know how to make them smaller either. And so we're trying to estimate this work. And after an hour, the two guys that debated for an hour, I noticed after a couple of rounds of this, that they said the same number at the beginning as they said at the end. And what I wanted to do was get through this stack of 10 or 15 stories, get them all estimated. And at this rate, we're going to have to spend 2 days on it. And that's not really what we wanted to do. You know, today I can look back at that and say the problem was the stories were too big to start with. But what do I do about this meeting? And so in my heritage is this thing called TQM. I mentioned it earlier. And one of the things that we used to do was do our brainstorming on Post-it notes or note cards or whatever. And so I kind of had this idea, why don't I have everybody take a break? And when we get back, wake up all the guys that were sleeping because the two architects were talking back and forth. And now read the story and everybody write a number on their note card about what the estimate was. And so they all did that. And after about 3 minutes, you know, so everybody did that. And then we showed our cards. And if the cards all agreed, people would move on. If there's a difference, the high and the low would talk, there'd be a revote, and we'd go on. So I was trying to get people to stop talking. Now, one of the benefits I hear from people about playing poker is how it really helps you talk about the story. And what I was trying to do is get people to shut up. Because these guys were talking way too much, agreeing for an hour. Okay, so after a few rounds of this and things are going smooth and we were talking about what was important, we weren't talking about what we agreed on. We were talking about what we didn't agree on. And after a few rounds, people had hands and had a few cards and they were like, it looked like we were all playing poker. And now another side funny thing about this is that we're in Salt Lake City. And well, the Mormons aren't known for playing cards and half the guys in the room are Mormons, and I just thought it looked like we were playing a poker game, so it kind of struck me. And then I hadn't written much before then, but Bob had always been encouraging me to write, so I thought, I'm going to write about this thing, and it looked like we're playing poker, so I'm going to call it Planning Poker. And so I wrote the little paper you can find on Wingman Software. In my resources, you can find that paper, rebranded with not Object Mentor on it, but with, you know, just my name or whatever. But the original paper is there, pretty much unedited, you'll see. Describing what planning poker is. And there were no Fibonacci numbers. There was none of the real rules, but it was about not communicating your ideas except everybody communicated all at once so that we could find out where we agreed quickly and move the discussion to where we didn't agree. Mike Cohn at the, I think it was the first Scrum Master training. I'm not positive. You might have to check with him, but he said, hey, I like your paper. Do you mind if I write about it in my book? And I said, sure, that'd be fine. And then a couple years later, he's printing up planning poker cards with the Fibonacci sequence on them. And so, hey, I guess you need a sequence when you're going to do a card deck. The Fibonacci sequence to me seems a little silly. It implies some precision that isn't there, which is what bothers me. I'd rather see numbers that end in zeros when they start getting bigger and people realize that the bigger numbers are budgetary. You can't really plan on, you know, that being what it costs for that story. It really means it's an uncertainty indicator. Low numbers means they're probably small enough where we understand them well enough to work on. Big numbers means we need to split some things out of it.
See, I think that's exactly, I'm going to send this down the rabbit hole now, but I think there's something beautiful to that. Cause even on some of the teams that I work with now, an 8 is a big story, but if it was 8,000, it would scare people and be like, oh, we actually have to slice this down a little bit further, right?
Yeah, I kind of think about them differently. I think, you know, when you throw some big number out in a backlog, you're saying, I don't know what that is so much. Mm-hmm. If it's really important to me, I better start finding some concrete things to do. So in this, for instance, this Internet of Things application I'm doing with my brother, it's like, okay, can I just get these radios to blab 10 times a second? Can I get 10 radios to blab 10 times a second to the box that collects all the messages? Mm-hmm. And that was like kind of a story, which meant nothing to the customer, except it's like, see, we understand how this technology works now. We can actually have it do that. We have to start taking these big value, high risk things and drawing some of the risky items out so we can learn and then turn it into something that you could actually understand well enough and plan. So, yeah, like an 8, if I was working with a new team, I would say, you can't pick an 8. How do we know if that 8 is done? Well, we would check this, and this. Okay, well, there's a 2-point story. Let's pull that out of there and let's work on that.
Right.
Let's not have anything that isn't a 1 or a 2.
Right. So I think I think we're going to be coming to a close soon here, but I just want to point out something that I realized as you were talking about the emergence of planning poker. When we first spoke about that XP week that you went to, and you took it unpaid and you thought it was just an opportunity where,
yep,
where, Kent and, Ron and Martin were aware of a problem and trying to find a realistic solution towards it. And you were saying that some people just have that natural proclivity. You actually did that with planning poker. So I think it's kind of a beautiful, full circle situation. So with that said, how would people get a hold of you, James, if they're looking to track you down? I know you've already dropped your website. Any other methods?
People can get a hold of me at wingman-sw.com. I've also got blog.wingman-sw.com that you can get at. I'm on Twitter, JW Grenning. Untapped, if you're a beer drinker, JW Grenning on Untapped. That can be fun for if you're on the road and you need to communicate with some of your beer drinking buddies around the world.
I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. I'll even put my Untapped in there, so hopefully we can get some more followers. Okay, well, we want to thank you, James, for your time with us today. We hope that that the listeners can enjoy this session and they can look through the library of the other Agile Manifesto authors that we've already interviewed. So, thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you guys. Really appreciate it.